Welcome to Enclave On Air. I'm your host today, Riley Kandel. In today's episode, we spoke with Jonathan Trent, MD, PhD. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Trent discussed currently approved TKIs for patients with gastrointestinal stromal tumors, including imatinib, sunitinib, regorafenib, and ripretinib. Trent dove into how these TKIs have improved outcomes for patients and touched on common adverse effects seen with these therapies, as well as how to manage these toxicities and maintain treatment adherence among patients. He also looked to liquid formulations of TKIs that are in development and the benefits they would bring to GIST management. How important is treatment adherence in achieving optimal outcomes with TKIs? And what are some of the most common challenges that you encounter when patients are taking these oral therapies long-term?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Gastrointestinal stromal tumor, or GIST, is a very aggressive tumor, and it is resistant to standard chemotherapies. And what's evolved over many years of research is that there are a number of kinases that are drivers of oncogenesis as sometimes seemingly single genetic events. For instance, the most common is KIT with mutations in exon 11 or 9. And then there's also platelet-derived growth factor receptor, alpha, is also activated by point mutations or small deletions in the autoinhibitory domain, which are exons, tend to be exon 12, most commonly, occasionally 18. And then after that, there's pretty rare kinases, but we've seen patients with mutations in RAF, V600E, mutations also in the term, in the context of translocations of TREC, NTREC, translocations of fibroblast growth factor receptor, and other rare kinases. But the majority, about 60 to 70% of patients, have mutations in KIT. And most of those are in exon 11. And these mutations are very exquisitely sensitive to imatinib, with response rates in the 80% or higher range. In fact, they're so effective that prior to TKIs, median overall survival was 9 months. And in the era of TKIs, in our internal data here at Sylvester, median overall survival is in excess of 7 years. So from 9 months to 7 years. And with all the new kinase inhibitors that are doing well in clinical trials and potentially heading towards approval, we expect that number to go even higher. So patients are on these medicines for a very long time. I have patients in my practice that have been on imatinib for more than 20 years. And so it's really, really effective in some patients. And so adherence is important. And the way that we approach it is really assessing the patient's quality of life, because typically a patient might not adhere to therapy because of side effects. So we take side effects management very, very seriously. It's not something to minimize. We all know efficacy is important, but if you don't manage side effects, then you end up with poor adherence. And so we always try to actively manage the side effects. We manage diarrhea with Imodium. We manage nausea with ondansetron or other agents. And if you proactively, sometimes if you treat the patient, you can get them on a regimen where they don't have the side effect. And we try to do that with each side effect. Try to manage it proactively so we don't have to reduce the dose. Because we know if the dose goes below a certain level, then we won't be able to inhibit the kinase. And so we do try to maintain dose intensity with an acceptable quality of life to the patient at the end of the day.
What are the currently FDA-approved TKIs? What different formulations are available? And what are the practical advantages and limitations of each when it comes to things like dosing, individualization, toxicity management, and therapeutic exposure?
So GIST patients are managed by tyrosine kinase inhibitors. The agents that we have in the United States that are FDA approved include imatinib, sunitinib, regorafenib, and ripretinib. there are three or four other kinase inhibitors that are being studied in various phases of clinical trial that could also be heading towards approval. And so the future is really bright with these oral agents. Now, at the same time, these are patients with GI cancers. And so they may have had some of their stomach resected or small intestine, and they may have tumors that are pushing on stomach or small intestine. And so oral agents can be challenging to deliver at times. We always do the best that we can. Sometimes, even though the label doesn't recommend it or discuss it, sometimes we do crush tablets and administer to patients as a solution or a slurry or in something like applesauce. We've even done it through feeding tubes before. And I don't think that that is FDA approved, so it's probably considered off label. But, we get desperate to take care of our patients at times. An FDA approved oral agent that is a liquid would be very welcome in my practice for patients with GIST.
In clinical practice, how do you routinely administer TKIs to patients? What questions should clinicians routinely ask patients to help identify issues with drug exposure?
Oral agents are increasingly common in our practice. We're all treating patients with cancer now with oral therapy. In the sarcoma space, when I first started treating patients, we only had IV medicines, really. So it's been a real learning curve, I believe, for a lot of us in oncology that we are increasingly using oral agents, which have a lot of advantages. They have a longer stability. These are daily agents usually, so you can make adjustments and fine-tune the dosing for toxicity. And so in my practice, standard dose for imatinib for a patient with a KIT exon 11 mutant GIST would be 400 milligrams a day in the metastatic or in the adjuvant setting, either one. That's the recommended FDA-approved dosing. Now, some patients with exon 9 mutation, there is some rationale to use a higher dose of imatinib, the 800 milligram dose, which comes with more imatinib-related side effects. So we end up really sometimes getting creative to identify the optimal dose for a patient with GIST. Data using therapeutic drug monitoring, looking at imatinib levels in patient plasma, didn't really pan out to be like a panacea for dosing, like we dose chemotherapy by body surface area. It's not the case. We start everybody at 400 milligrams, and what we end up doing, rather than dosing based on weight, is dosing based on side effects so that we can treat the patient at close as we can get to the targeted dose without causing unacceptable toxicity. So in my practice, we'll use a crescendo approach often where we might start a patient at 200 milligrams a day of imatinib. And this is true for sunitinib, regorafenib, and ripretinib. But we might start them at 200 milligrams a day, see how they do for 2 weeks, have a clinic visit, discuss side effects, check labs, make sure there's no liver toxicity and anemia, namely. And if they're doing well at 200, we might increase them to 400 and see how they do. And do that slowly over time. For sunitinib, we might start at 12.5. For regorafenib, we might start at 200 or 400 milligrams a day. And for ripretinib, we also will do the same thing, depending on how we anticipate the patient will accept the medicine, how the patient will manage the toxicities. Now, it gets a little tricky when the patient's at 200 milligrams a day of imatinib, and you think they might not be ready for 400, but they're doing pretty well at 200. They're having some side effects. So you can maybe give it another week or two, reassess, and then dose escalate to 400. Or we might want to give 300 for a couple weeks. But 300 milligrams a day is difficult because A 400 milligram day tablet you can break in half, and you can give 200 milligrams a day with a pill cutter. But if I want to give 300 milligrams a day, it's gets a lot more complicated. You can't really feasibly use a pill cutter to divide a tablet into four 100 milligram doses. You could send a new prescription for 100 milligram tablets and then get them up to 400 and then send a prescription for 400, but that generates a lot of work, a lot of difficulty. But that type of approach where you slowly increase the dose until you get to target is very effective. In fact, I've had several patients who were started at 400 milligrams and they had too much toxicity, so they were referred to me for imatinib intolerance. And what we did was started them at 200 milligrams every other day. And they did great. After 2 weeks, we went to 200 milligrams a day for 2 weeks. And then we went to 400 milligrams, alternating with 200 milligrams every other day. And then we're able to get to the target of 400 milligrams over about 6 weeks. And they tolerated it fine when they didn't tolerate starting at 400 milligrams as the initial dose.
Are there certain populations of patients who you think would derive particular benefit from liquid formulations of TKIs as opposed to oral agents?
A liquid formulation of a tyrosine kinase inhibitor would give us the flexibility of dosing at 100 milligram, 200, 300, 400, or in between those doses for imatinib. It would give us a lot of flexibility. It would even give more flexibility for an agent like sunitinib, which is a capsule. You can't really divide a capsule with a pill cutter, so it's very difficult to adjust the dose of sunitinib on the fly. And then for all of the TKIs, the liquid formulation could help a lot with adherence due to the fact that these patients often have some baseline degree of GI upset because they may have had some of their stomach removed or small intestine removed, and they may have some baseline nausea. And a pill, from my experience, is oftentimes more difficult to manage than a liquid in terms of GI symptoms.
What is important to know about liquid formulations of TKIs as opposed to oral agents?
I think a liquid oncolytic therapy would be welcomed by many patients because it gives them a different option of dosing and more flexibility in the amount that they're taking a day. For instance, the patient on imatinib might like have no side effects at 300 milligrams a day, but their tumor might be starting to grow and they can't tolerate 400. So liquid dosing would allow more flexible dosing amounts for a patient who's on therapy, and seems to have some dose response relationship. Liquid dosing would also be ideal for patients who have GIST, who may have had a gastric surgery, and maybe they're not able to tolerate oral intake, but they might have a G tube or a J tube or some type of feeding tube that a liquid could be administered to get them on their much needed therapy rather than waiting months for healing after a big, large gastrointestinal surgery. The GIST oncologist community has wanted something like that for a very long time. We need the flexibility to be able to deliver therapy to patients who need it. And sometimes an oral tablet, or even worse, a capsule, is difficult to administer to a patient. So it's something that I have had my eye on for many years as a welcome addition to our arsenal for managing and optimizing treatment of GIST patients.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive. and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thank you again for listening to OncLive on Air.